Okay, well, good afternoon. Welcome to Future of Life Insurance. So we have two speakers with us. We have Angad, excuse me, is a partner and one of the founding members of Oliver Wyman's Sydney office. He currently leads the Australian Insurance and Wealth Management practice. Angad is passionate about the role data analytics and technology are playing in fundamentally changing the nature. Well, this is long. Changing the nature of the insurance industry, and is working on helping his clients respond to this change. Angad is a busy guy. He regularly publishes on these topics in trade journals, presents at industry conferences such as these. Prior to joining Oliver Wyman, bit of history, Angad worked at Macquarie Bank, Towers Watson. He's a CFA holder as well as a financial risk manager designation. Our second speaker is Justin. Justin is the head of insurance strategy for AMP. He manages the strategy function within the life insurance business, underwriting policy and governance, and holds end-to-end accountability for reinsurance, which is a busy area, as we know, from setting strategy to operational execution. He commenced at AMP in October 2014. Prior to AMP, Justin was with MLC, NABWEL, General Insurance, Agribusiness. Justin served the industry through various FSC working groups and provides assistance to the ANZIF on the delivery of content to visiting Chinese delegations. Very interesting. So that's a bit of intro. I'm sure these guys have a great session. We'll have a Q&A session after this. Just a quick reminder, if you have a question, please use the microphone and please introduce yourself before asking the question.
Excellent. Thank you, Jazz, for that very elaborate introduction. I think you got both Justin and my titles wrong, but that's okay. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I think over the next 20 minutes or so, Justin and I will talk through some thoughts around the future of our fantastic industry. I'll focus my comments mostly around what we see some of the global players do in the space, and then Justin will bring it back to the Australian market and talk about how some of the local players are responding. So in thinking about such a broad topic, we thought it'd be helpful to paint a scenario of what the future could look like. So imagine you're in the year 2025. Maria is a millennial. She's walking into an estate agency's store, and being a millennial, wants to buy a house. The house price, her budget is around $3 million. She clearly lives in Sydney for a one-bedroom apartment. The agent says he's got something right exactly for her, as he would. He gives her the VR glasses. She has a scan and, you know, being a millennial, says, yep, found what I like and would like to buy. So she looks at her, she talks to her smartwatch, Alexa, and says, tell me my financial position. The watch tells her that she does have $3 million in assets, but she wants to only liquidate a million of those as deposit for this. So the Alexa tells her that she'll need a mortgage for $2 million and also informs her that her credit rating has expired and she should also reconsider her life insurance needs given that she's taking on a new loan. She says, yes, that makes sense. Send me all the information. The smartwatch processes everything because it stored all her information there and says she has a B-plus credit rating and an A-minus health risk score. The watch also recommends that she should take on an insurance of $1.5 million because that's a shortfall relative to her loan. She's like, yeah, that all makes sense. She talks to Alexa again and says, okay, search for the best mortgage offers and the life insurance offers. The watch processes and within a few seconds says it's found 5 offers for you and the recommended score. The recommended ones are X and Y. The watch prompts whether she needs financial advice and, you know, being a very confident millennial, she's like, no, nah, I'm good. And she says, that'll be it. So happy with the purchase, she signs off through her fingerprint scanner and walks out of the real estate store 20 minutes afterwards with a key card to her house and her life insurance needs met. Many of you will think, well, sounds a bit crazy. We're very, very far away from such a scenario emanating. And perhaps that is the case. And this is obviously one potential scenario of how insurance purchases may go down in the future. But if you think deeply around what's actually transpired in this very hypothetical scenario, insurance is being sold as part of another purchase, an important life event, and we have that today. It is very, very customized to a particular person. We're far away from that, but it's debatable how far we are. The process itself is very seamless. We're very far away from that, but that certainly is the way we see the industry panning out. So if we bring it back to the reality today, customer trust in the insurance industry is probably at an all-time low. This is a study that was done by the Association of British Insurers in the UK, where they looked at consumer trust across different industries and geographies. And the first thing that stands out is that insurance relative to most industries is materially lower. I think the second thing is if you compare the Australian market relative to some of the others, and particularly the Australia and the UK, insurance is materially lower than many of the other industries, and particularly the banks. And if you think about some of the unfortunate issues that we've had in our industry around conduct, it sort of helps, you know, put some of this in context. So customer trust is low. If you look at longer-term trends around insurance sales across some markets, there's some pretty horrible trends. The left-hand side is showing life insurance sales in the U.S. So barring a rapid rise in the early 2000s, primarily a structural decline for the industry. The right-hand side shows some stats around the level of coverage, people that are covered across Europe. And again, the trend is downwards. If you look at Australia numbers, the story isn't as stark. New sales are declining, but still positive. But if you look deeper, most of the new business is coming from agent CPI increases relative to true new sales. So again, you know, it might not be as dire as the situation here, but the reality is consumers are losing trust in the industry and showing it through their purchasing behavior. If you look at shareholders' perspectives on the life insurance industry, the left-hand side chart shows the MSCI Global Index post-2007. The green chart shows the returns for the life sector. Now, this includes a lot of life cos that have investment products linked to them, and arguably they've had a better run, particularly post-crisis. So if it was pure protection players, the chart could actually be even worse. And if you marry that with growth rates across different markets, what you find is the post-crisis growth rates are materially lower than the pre-crisis rates. In most of the developed markets, growth rates are sub 5%, and in some they're actually negative. I mean, emerging markets, particularly Asia, they're a different story. But you sort of sum all that up and you think, well, customer trust is low, they're purchasing less of our products, shareholders are unhappy and arguably pulling out of the sector and going elsewhere. So it's a pretty dire picture of the global state of our industry. Yet we all know, those of us who work in the industry and are passionate about the role it plays, that it does play a very, very critical role in individuals' lives, and particularly those that have gone through an event will realize the importance it has. And so insurers have a massive task ahead of not only restoring trust, but doing so in a credible manner. So if you look ahead, I think there's sort of four broad trends that are playing out that we think will fundamentally reshape how the life insurance sector will exist 10 years from now. We've spoken a bit about customer trust and expectations that are changing very rapidly. I think if we fast forward 5 to 10 years ahead, not only will there be a desire for simple product structures, there'll be a demand for products that are customized for individuals, where the purchase process, similar to the fictional story that I shared, is as seamless, not intrusive, and very, very straightforward. Technology, a lot spoken about the role technology is playing in other sectors. Think It has the potential in life insurance, but we're yet to see a lot of true innovation where it has really sort of shaken up how the sector operates. But as I'll share through a few examples later, you'll see that already there's rapid evolution that's happening in terms of how organizations are deploying data analytics, how they're starting to use robotics for things like claims management, as well as underwriting, where some of the players are actually not only doing underwriting in weeks or months, but actually in a few minutes. Regulation, I'm sure for those of you who have had anything to do with our sector in the last few years, there's a fair bit of that. And certainly from a conduct perspective, we'd expect more. I think one of the most exciting regulatory developments is around the use of data. And if you saw the Productivity Commission's report last week, the sense of direction for the Australian market is that from 2 or 3 years from now, consumers will have the ability to share their data with any provider that they want. And if you think about sort of the potential that brings, both a threat to many incumbents, but also tremendous opportunities for players who are able to better harness the power of that data to provide better services for their customers. Finally, new competitors. Again, you know, we've had mixed results in the Australian market around non-traditional players being able to penetrate the sector. But if you look at what's happening in some of the other markets, and particularly markets like China, where sort of technology-based players like Alibaba have developed ecosystems around their customers, where not only were they initially just selling retail products, now they're offering general insurance products, health insurance products, and it's a matter of time before life insurance sort of becomes embedded into their portal. There's a player called Zhong'an, which some of you may have heard of, a startup, started about 2 or 3 years ago, currently has a valuation of $8 billion and sells over 8 million, I think, or 7 million policies per year on shipping returns. So they created a new product that was around a customer need and have had tremendous success. And again, if we think, you know, 5 to 10 years out, we certainly believe that those players that have the sort of no legacy technology issues, are very, very advanced in their use of data analytics, and have access to customer information, will be much, much better positioned to operate in that space. So I've painted a picture of the industry being almost in structural decline. There's a lots of trends that are happening that are impacting and providing both challenges and opportunities for insurers. And now I'll talk about sort of three ways in which global life insurers are responding to these. So first is trying to sort of build and restore customer trust. There's been a lot of effort locally as well as globally around just short-term sort of tactical reactive measures around responding to media inquiries, responding to regulatory inquiries. Most of them ineffective, but kind of have to be done because there's so much focus and negative sentiment around the industry. And this is not just true locally, it's also true globally. Second is starting to think about are there initiatives you can take to better engage with customers more proactively? And companies like AXA and Zurich globally have done very well in looking at the existing blocks of business and saying, you know, these are customers we've had for years. We've largely ignored them. Can we sort of start to focus on them and better serve their needs, focus on retention, focus on cross-sell, and just broader engagement? There's companies like, you know, MetLife and Principal Group who operate multiple businesses across life insurance, asset management, and they've realized that a lot of the products that they have, they're not suitable for customers as they age. And so they both have carved out businesses that are just focused on retirement and are developing not just sort of variable annuity type products, but a whole range of offerings that they think will better meet customers' needs as they get into the later stages of their life. And finally, I think for me, the most exciting is organizations that are going beyond just some of these sort of tactical things and focusing on products that are fundamentally reorganizing themselves around customer needs. And USAA, for me, is certainly one example. And for those that don't know, they are a sort of insurance and financial services provider that sort of serves the military personnel and their families in the U.S. Set up about 100 years ago. And what they've done in the last 7 or 8 years is said, rather than just selling auto insurance products and life insurance products and banking products, we're going to reorganize our business across 7 moments that matter across the customer's life. And everything we do, every conversation that we have with the customer will be around those 7 moments. And there's a range of products that will be relevant for those, but we need to have the conversation that's structured around those. And they reorganize their entire organization and develop propositions that will focus around serving those needs. And if you look at the NPS scores, between 2009 and 2015, they beat out Amazon and Apple and Costco to be sort of the highest rated organization from a customer satisfaction perspective. The second lever, which is clearly very important for shareholders of organizations, is around restoring or arresting the decline in profitability. And a range of different approaches have been taken by players. First is players getting clearer around where they're focused and balancing their portfolios accordingly. So companies like Prudential, they decided that they wanted to get exposure to emerging markets. And as we saw earlier, that's where a lot of the growth has been. So about greater than 20% of Prudential's profits comes from the Indonesian market. You know, they're a UK-based company, but 20% comes from just one market in Southeast Asia. Aviva has gone the other way around. They realized that they were too spread out, and they sort of retreated to the core and said, no, we're going to focus primarily on the UK and some European markets. Cost efficiency, most global players have gone through waves of traditional cost-cutting, things like offshoring, outsourcing, and, you know, taken out between 5 and 10%. What's transpired for a lot of them is that after the initial rounds of cuts, those costs have crept back into the organization. And now the round two of this is focusing around more fundamental shifts. So the conversations that are happening at these players is, it's not about 3 to 5% through offshoring and outsourcing. How can we take out 20 to 30% by fundamentally redesigning our processes, by starting to use things like robotic process automation, things like open APIs and modular architecture to significantly reduce the overhang that's associated with a lot of their legacy. Around balance sheet, we've already seen both locally as well as globally players starting to take advantage of lower cost of capital, be it through reinsurers or through alternative capital providers. And fourthly, for me, and probably one of the most exciting ones, is where organizations are starting to improve their core operations around underwriting and our claims management. And the example, which has actually changed in the last week or so, is around AIG and Two Sigma. So for those of you that are not familiar, Two Sigma is a hedge fund which makes a lot of money by quant trading. And they approached Hamilton, which is another insurer, and AIG, and said, we've got some of the smartest brains in the business. We believe we can build better predictive models than, you know, that you guys ever have built. So AIG said, well, why don't we set up a partnership and see what you can do? And as of last week, AIG ended up buying up Two Sigma. And similarly, lots of sort of activity happening where organizations are starting to think about, well, there's a lot we can do around just the existing activities that we focus on, but where's sort of the next wave of growth going to come from? And many of the large organizations have set up large venture funds where they're just scanning the technology scene and seeing, okay, where are the players that are having a fundamental impact on efficiency? Where are players that are helping us create new offerings that we may not be able to create because we just don't have either the right people or the capabilities? Final thing is insurers are trying to, you know, bulletproof themselves against the future, but the reality is there's so much change happening so quickly that there's no one really has a clue as to whether life insurance will remain as it exists today or it will fundamentally change. And so what players are doing are taking a portfolio of bets on themes that they think are going to be important for their customers. So USAA has invested in a company called Saffron Tech, which uses advanced algorithms to improve its recommendations around what a customer's needs are going to be and thereby what products they will need. And just by deploying better algorithms, they found that they were able to improve their predictive scores by over 50%. AXA has set up a volunteer portal to give their customers who are minded that way access to a whole bunch of volunteer activity. Again, they don't make any money from it, but they realize it's important to their customers. It helps build affinity with them. Similarly, USAA gives a lot of its customers free access to a site called care.com. And what that does is provides connects customers with a portal where if they want help for aged care, for babysitting, for house minding, for tuition, they can get access to that. And so they're realizing that, you know, their customers have day-to-day needs which an insurer may not be able to, you know, to meet, but can it partner with other companies such that it helps build sort of more loyalty and affinity with those organizations. Finally, in the health space, again, there certainly is a view held by many life cos globally that although we've focused on mortality risk and measuring and understanding life insurance, customers are more concerned about managing their health because that's what they sort of impacts their day-to-day living. And therefore, a lot of players are focusing on investments in health companies from not only helping organizations or customers better manage their healthcare plans to find better health products, but also simple things like helping them identify when their GP practice, where is the closest GP practice, helping them book appointments and just sort of simplify their day-to-day life. So if I sum up in terms of what's happening globally, you know, a lot of focus around restoring customer centricity, a lot of focus in the short term that with the to keeping shareholders happy and a range of levers being deployed. And thirdly, not much clarity around what the future is going to be, and therefore a range of bets being taken in terms of where the future products are likely to come from.
Fantastic. Thank you for that, Angad. Before I start, there was an earlier slide that Angad displayed around trust in our industry globally and comparing it to other categories. And if you took a close look at that slide, there was one category in one geography that had a lower level of trust than our own. Can anyone remember or recall what it was? UK Bank. Say again?
UK Bank.
UK banks? No, it was actually the automotive industry in the US. Now, I just wonder when we did that survey, the ABI completed that survey, if that was really a reflection of the motives and actions of General Motors Holden or General Motors in the US post the GFC. Fascinating to see that play out. So you've heard that trust is low in our industry. New business flow is in structural decline and the returns are poor in our industry. And obviously Angad articulated the potential responses from a global perspective around this situation. And that was really around customer centricity and engaging customers from a retention perspective and from a preventative claims management perspective. Obviously, re-establishing profitability is important globally. And it's important globally, and it's also very important for us here in the Australian market. And then he spoke about bulletproofing the future, and in particular, the advantages that fintech or insurtech, as we like to refer to it provide our industry from an engagement perspective, provide our industry from an efficiency perspective, provide our industry from effectiveness perspective. So significant advantages there. So what does that mean in the Australian context? And of course, it's fair to say we have challenges galore. And the one thing, of course, is our profitability. And we all talk about profitability in the Australian market. But this slide is a fantastic slide through the cycle of where our margin has moved in the industry. Long-term structural decline doesn't take account of capitalised losses, but really talks to not only the growth that we all know about in the market, but the shrinking profit pool in our market at the same time. At the same time, there's been an emergence of stronger players in the market. And we've seen significant offshore capital come into our domestic market. The North Asian insurers find the Australian market particularly attractive. We've had some Europeans and North Americans enter the market. And, of course, there is potentially activity around a number of other players in the market. So it's fascinating to see this play out from a cost of capital perspective and a margin target perspective. Obviously, that has implications for all participants in the industry. And then lastly, the omnipresent issue for our industry, and that's one of regulation. Now, when we speak of regulation, we think of regulation from a manufacturer's conduct perspective, how the manufacturer manufactures a product, how that manufacturer takes it to market, how the manufacturer expects the product to behave. Equally, consumers want to understand how the product behaves. The regulator wants to understand how the product behaves. Distribution, a strong focus for our industry the past 3 to 4 years. Conflicted remuneration, commission rates, APL construction. So a lot of heat from both a manufacturer's perspective and a distributor's perspective. And then the third piece, which has become of particular relevance over the past 12 to 18 months, is around product design. Ensuring our product design remains contemporary, that it does what consumers think it will do while keeping the interests of shareholders in mind. And obviously product definitions has played out in a rather vocal way in that manner. So significant challenges from a margin perspective, from a cost of capital and a competition perspective, and from a regulatory perspective. So really, how do you respond to what's happening internationally and how that is playing out in the domestic life insurance market? And there's really things here and now that we can respond to as an industry to help change the dynamics and conduct, the way we serve customers, and how we create a more sustainable profitability set. So the first one is really a transition away from having a value chain that's integrated to cutting up the value chain. And we really cut up the value chain from an efficiency perspective, an effectiveness perspective, and an agility perspective. And what this really goes to show is what is the core competitive advantage of the life insurer in our industry in the future? Is it around the corporate services, the middle office, the IT systems, the fulfillment management? Is it around the core manufacturing of the proposition, the contract design, the pricing, the definitions, managing the standards around fulfillment? Is it around data management and claims policy? All of us will have different views given where our organisations are today, where our industry is today, the competitive advantages we have today, and where we think opportunity exists in the future. One hypothesis is that the core manufacturing capabilities that are articulated in the orange on the slide have high strategic value. They create the competitive advantage. A number of you in the room would debate that issue. Likewise with the middle office, some would debate the issue around fulfillment, underwriting operations, and claims operations. So we shouldn't take this as a set and forget view of how we chop up the value chain, but take it as a view of how the value chain could emerge in the future, how we create efficiency in our industry, how we chase effectiveness, and effectiveness around delivering the proposition to customer and delivering a profitable, sustainable product set to our shareholder, and an agility perspective. And we all know the world's changing. Angat spoke about that in depth. How do we make sure that we don't get trapped in the legacy of today by chopping up our value chain today to provide us with the opportunity to be more agile in the future? The second piece is really thinking around the proposition and how we deliver the proposition to market. And at the heart of this idea is taking the proposition view and partnering the proposition to the customer. Knowing full well that there's brands, adjacent offerings, adjacent services that actually add value to the core protection offering. So if you think of health management in the first instance, there's a perfect alignment of interest between a customer and a manufacturer. The customer doesn't want to die. The customer doesn't want to get sick. The customer doesn't want to have an accident. So how can we better embed and offer health management as an adjacent offering to the core protection option? This may lead to a conversation around the personal protection portfolio. And that's what we really call the all protection needs. How can I manage my health insurance? How can I manage my personal lines insurance, my home and my motor? How can I manage my life insurance offering? How can I bundle it and really take that to a lifestyle services view of the world? How do I manage my wellness? How do I manage my financial situation? How do I manage my income and protection needs? So what's interesting in the future is, what are the adjacency plays available to us that create value for the customer and the customer can align to from a branding and proposition perspective? So what's today being about? So really the first point is that our model will change. Our model will change. The business model that we had in the 70s and 80s, evolved in the 90s and the 2000s, will evolve again over the next 10 to 20 years. How do we position ourselves for that change? We'll focus on the end customer, not the intermediary. The end customer will be king, and the end customer will be enabled by digital tools, by better understanding their risk profile explicitly and implicitly. Our product design and the way we interact with those customers will complement that and provide opportunity for further expansion. The third point is really a no-regrets move. Angat spoke about data, he spoke around digital, but really the heart here is not only having the analytics capability, but to actually drive that analytics capability into making decisions on a daily basis, explicitly and implicitly, real time. Not worrying about time lags, but making it real time, given we've built the analytics capability. Digital is essential for the engagement. Engagement with end customer, engagement with future customer, engagement with other participants across the value chain. And then finally, the landscape has changed, and no doubt it will change in the future. So we need to think about our role in that changing landscape, how we will participate across the life insurance value chain, and where we will participate across the life insurance value chain. I might leave it there and open the floor to questions, Jazz.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin. Angat, do you have any questions? I'll kick off with a question. I noticed loss of trust was blamed for a lot of things, loss of customer trust, rather. And then we talked about going forward, increased customer focus and so on. Just wondering if you guys can elaborate on what else led to the loss of the customer trust.
Yeah, so let me start. So I think the reality of the matter is we're starting from a position of a low base. And the reason for that is twofold. I think one is we don't really even proactively try and engage with customers, you know, over their life cycle. I mean, till recently, most of the engagement was you sell a product, you send a renewal notice, and now that's starting to improve a lot. But awareness of what individuals cover is, how important it is, it's just not there. So I think you're starting from a low base where awareness is like, yeah, we have something, don't really know what it is, but it's there. And then there's been cases, and again, you know, perhaps exemplified by a few events, and perhaps exaggerated by a few events, which have, hit the media, and the impact has just been amplified. And that's not just locally. I mean, if you look at what happened in the PPI scandals in the UK, those organisations were fined billions, and the coverage associated with that, you know, did leave a fairly, I would say, almost near permanent scar in individuals' minds.
Yeah, I think the irony there is increased awareness possibly led to low trust. In some ways.
You're comparing against.
the PPI scandal in the UK, I think, made people realise they actually had insurance, and prior to that, they didn't have any.
Yes.
Okay, I've got a question then. Well, first of all, I'll make a comment on your first slide about the story and stuff, about 2025. I very much doubt that a millennial will be actually going into an estate agent for a house. I suspect they'll be doing it different ways. But that wasn't what my question was. So do you think that Australian insurers are going to move far enough and quick enough, or do you think they're under threat that other insurers from other markets who are potentially moving faster will want they move into Australia in 5 years' time and completely change the landscape? Or are we all okay?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Rob. And it really comes back to my second slide around chopping the value chain up. And there's some great examples globally where groups have got together around building the proposition, building the look and feel, building the customer experience, done an extensive amount of customer testing around what the customer wants, how they want it delivered to them, and when they want it delivered to them. And then they've gone off and searched for the insurance risk capital. So you've had the advent of, you know, the likes of Ladder Life in the US, I think is a great example, where a group of guys together in the Silicon Valley brought something to market, pure term-death play, built up the proposition after the founder's experience with the passing of his own father, and actually went out and searched for the insurance risk capital. Now, obviously, we don't have the population of the US, but I think it's a great example of what can happen in the market as we potentially import those types of ideas, those types of business model configurations into the Australian industry context. So I can envisage an industry in 10 to 15 years' time that has an increased degree of segmentation from a customer needs perspective, from a socioeconomic perspective, from a product offering perspective, and I can imagine that would be configured from the more traditional, what we see in the market today, to the more cutting edge. And when I think of cutting edge, we may not see pure insurance risk capital backing those enterprises. It may be something very different that we can't envisage today.
Yeah, I just had one comment. I think if you look at what's been happening in the Australian market the last, you know, couple of years, we've already had a lot of overseas capital come in. And I certainly have a pretty strong view that we'll see much more of that in the next 24 months. And I guess only you have to look at what's happened in the GI industry over the last 3-4 years, where prior to 3 or 4 years ago, it was two large brands in the personal line space, and now they're being attacked by a whole bunch of challenger brands, some homegrown, and some coming from other markets. And the precipitous for that is it's most developed markets globally, the macro conditions are tougher than the Australian market. So even though we've had it bad, they look at the Australian market and say, hey, we can get 7% profitability. That's better than 2% in the US. So why don't we, at least express interest? So I certainly have a view that, we've had some interest, but there'll be much more competitive action happening from new players.
Any other questions? I think we have about 5 minutes. Yeah, we do.
Few moments. Justin Angert, thank you. Catherine Gobby, AM Life. About Justin, your point about cutting up the value chain and partnership approach and outsourcing. I guess taking that approach requires a need and a want to be in a partnership and a need and a want to make that change. And I guess the message I hear a lot still is that outsourcing is a dirty word in the industry. What more has to happen, do you think, to create that need and want?
Yeah, it's a good question. Thanks for that. You would have noticed I didn't use outsourcing as a term, because I think outsourcing is the technical term for taking a capability that's in-house today and sending it to a third party or sending it offshore to a third party. So I didn't use the term outsourcing and offshoring. Perhaps I can think about it. Perhaps I could articulate it or answer your question by articulating the problem in a different manner. The industry's ability to change is obviously hampered by the legacy. The legacy is its strength, but it's also its greatest weakness. Customers will demand more in the future, and our best opportunity to move quickly to fulfil their needs is actually saying, in very simplistic terms, what's our old code, what's our new code? What's our go-forward position today? And how can we act to orchestrate the value chain to take the proposition to the customer? Now, we may be a participant in that orchestra, and we also may be the conductor of that. We will conduct the orchestra, and we'll be a member of the orchestra, some components of the orchestra. The key is actually searching out those capabilities and aligning your strategic views around the end customer proposition, not being caught up in the fact that we need you to do X, Y, Z to deliver ABC to market, but actually creating a shared vision and a shared strategic narrative of what the industry or your offering could look like in the future.
Yeah, I think just one additional comment from me. I think a lot of your question for me is actually, it's about the mindset of the organisation, right? So I think there absolutely needs to be recognition that you need to change. If there isn't that recognition, then, bugger partnerships. There's no point. So I think that degree of recognition for change varies, even within our industry across different players. Ultimately comes down to the people and how much they buy into the story that the industry is changing, and therefore how much they want to be on the front foot. I think the second mindset issue is perhaps challenging whether you are the best player to do something versus that there are sort of betters that can provide services which you or your organization has done for years and years. And again, I think that also can be challenging from a cultural perspective, because data analytics, as an example, the industry has done that for hundreds of years. And I just spoke about an example where a hedge fund said, no, we can do it better. Now, most insurance companies may have said, no, you can't, you know nothing about us. And in that instance, the world's biggest insurance company is like, no, let's give this a go and see what we can find.
I think we have time for one question. Okay, well, I'll ask a question. Now, one of the things I've been curious about is, yes, the increased customer focus is the key, but what sort of investment in the business, what sort of management caliber will cut it in the life insurance industry of the future?
Yeah, so I think, the concept of customer centricity is not anything new, right? So I think a lot of organizations have been talking about this for almost decades. So question is, what's changing? I think the pace of investment is changing. And it's not just, okay, let's appoint a chief customer officer and that kind of, will solve our problems. I think it's truly, thinking about, do we actually firstly understand what the customer's needs are? Right. Rather than just, hey, let's do some campaigns and let's develop some products, do we understand what their needs are? Because for a lot of customers, the reality is they may not actually need, if they're in their mid to late 50s to early 60s, the need for an insurance product is less so. But insurers then have to trade off, well, we currently only have insurance products. If we engage with them and tell them that the need for this product is low, they're sort of trading off value. And unless they have a proposition that they can sort of move them to, there's less of an incentive for them to do so. So this first step organizations are doing is actually understanding what those needs are. I think secondly, and you see this more so in global life cos, is they're bringing in individuals from outside of insurance, particularly life insurance, many from retail, many from consumer goods industries, where they're interacting with these customers multiple times a week and trying to just bring in learnings from those industries to see, well, how can we become a little bit more customer-centric than we are today.
Great. Great. Well, thank you. I think we're out of time. So could you please join me in thanking the two speakers?